I do many, many things. I am a writer, a doctor, a nuclear physicist, a theoretical philosopher. But above all, I am a man. Hopelessly inquisitive man, just like you.
And he said, I feel like you're spiting me. Do you think I took this job to spite you?
For 24 years, people have been trying to kill me. People know how. Now, do you think that's because my dad was a Greek soda pop maker? Or do you think that's because I'm an American spy?
Idiot. I'm an idiot.
This is Movie Geeks United. Tonight we're discussing one of our greatest actors, Mr. Philip Seymour Hoffman. Sadly, we're discussing his legacy tonight because yesterday he was found dead at the age of 46. Much too soon he's been taken from us. But tonight we'd like to celebrate his contribution to the art of acting and the world of a film and stage. He was a really accomplished stage actor, too, and I'm joined by Dean and Jerry both. Hey, guys.
Hey, how are you?
This is the second actor in a row. I mean, we had Gandolfini a few months back that taken from us just way, way too soon, and both incredibly accomplished actors that you felt like only kind of scratched the surface.
I'm still sort of like kind of in shock a little bit, you know, about it. I came in yesterday from the movies, you know, in a pretty good mood, and then, you know, seeing this news, you know, immediately, I just kind of threw myself into writing a remembrance of him, you know, to keep my sanity about me in some ways, you know. But yes, an incredible, like, immeasurable loss.
It's not so much, it's not like when River Phoenix died and Heath Ledger died, where we knew there was, I mean, you had somewhat of a body of work and you knew that there were great things were going to come from those two. Here we knew we had 20-plus years, and we knew there was probably another 25, even 30 years. Just this year alone, there are three movies coming out that, I'm looking forward to seeing, but it's not going to be, it's going to be a different, obviously, way of viewing them. I'm stunned.
Well, and he's definitely one of those actors, one of those very few actors where you say to yourself, well, I'll see him in anything. And there was actually Saturday night, a friend of mine, we were in conversation, and Saturday night he said, yeah, I'll see Philip Seymour Hoffman in anything. He's the one actor that I look forward to seeing in anything. And then hours later he was found dead. So, I mean, for people that love movies, obviously for the casual viewer as well, that I'm sure knew him, because he very adeptly kind of towed that line between supporting and lead actor throughout his career. But for people that truly love movies, I mean, he was one of the seminal actors. And considering his output, it is jaw-dropping how versatile he was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you put Flawless, which is a tremendous performance, like his first lead performance in the Joel Schumacher film.
Mm-hmm.
You put that against something like Capote, that's not the same person.
How long have you been doing this?
Singing?
Oh, this very clean type of thing.
I've been in musicals at school ever since I was a little kid. You know, I was Prince Jalongkorn in The King and I. But I was miscast. Then I was the lion in The Wizard of Oz, and I was definitely miscast, but I was the only one that, fat enough to fit into the costume, whatever. And then in The Snow Queen, where I was again totally miscast as the king, we were all on stage, and they had made these dry ice kettles so, like, smoke could come out of them, you know? And one night, all of a sudden, one dry ice kettle exploded, and dry ice flew everywhere. I Well, Pretty Little Miss No Talent,
who was playing the Snow Queen,
dashed off the stage screaming and pulling her hair out. Well, the play must go on, I believe. And she had dropped a crown.
Well, honey, I just picked up that crown, put it on my head, and I was the greatest Snow Queen in the history of PS11 Paramus, New Jersey.
Well, just look at, another important point. Oh, you say flawless. And what does that come out along with Magnolia and The Talented Mr. Ripley in the same time period? I mean, the same month, if I'm not mistaken. It's amazing. And he did that. He did that every year. Something like Happiness and Patch Adams or, it was always, he would have three or four different roles in the span of a couple months, and they're all completely different.
You know, when I first saw him, I didn't like him. Years ago when he did Scent of a Woman, basically because I didn't know what he was capable of. I just...
Right.
And it's a testament to how good he was, because I just saw him as that completely arrogant, spoon-fed character. And
a
tremendous gutless weasel in that movie. And I was thinking, oh, God, there's something about that guy I just don't like. And so I never expected he would be this actor of such depth and versatility and warmth and humanity that he showed, throughout the years since then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Eventually, obviously, he became a big favorite. And every movie I saw of his, and we would talk about each movie since we've been doing the show, it always came up that Philip Seymour Hoffman, it's just great. It felt like a Meryl Streep kind of thing. Well, of course he's great. He's Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Right. But you bring up that greatness, and, I really had to, stop myself yesterday because I went back and read this review I'd written when Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. And I had, I haven't seen it in quite some time, and I had forgotten what his character, and just reading about what his character of an addict, and some of these performances like Love, Liza, or even the one that you mentioned yesterday, Jamie, Oney Mahoney, he was an expert at playing characters with really deep-seated addictions. And now we know
great art
comes from a very dark place. I mean,
the first time I heard about his addiction problems, which was a few months ago when he went to rehabilitation, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead was the first thing I thought of, because obviously that's a heroin addict that he plays in that movie, which brings up another point. He's, I said something like he wasn't afraid to play the unflattering, and by saying unflattering, essentially I'm saying human. The human, that the person that just wakes up out of bed and isn't made up, or the guy that's a complete disappointment for others and himself, or the guy, he wanted to kind of plumb those depths. There was a fearlessness, even if you look at something like Doubt, where that performance is a complete high wire act, because did he do it? Did he not do it? And you look for the little indications in the performance, and you can go either way with him. And so he's just stunning. You automatically feel a warmth towards him, but in Doubt, there's also always that nagging suspicion.
Mm-hmm. A woman was gossiping with a friend about a man she hardly knew. I know none of you have ever done this. That night she had a dream. A great hand appeared over her and pointed down at her. She was immediately seized with an overwhelming sense of guilt. The next day she went to confession. She got the old parish priest, Father O'Rourke. She told him the whole thing.
Is gossiping a sin?
She asked the old man. Was that the hand of God Almighty pointing a finger at me? Should I be asking your absolution, Father? Tell me, have I done something wrong?
Yes,
Father O'Rourke answered her.
Yes, you ignorant, badly brought up female. You've borne false witness against your neighbor. You played fast and loose with his reputation, and you should be heartily ashamed.
So, the woman said she was sorry and asked for forgiveness.
Not so fast,
says O'Rourke.
I want you to go home, take a pillar upon your roof, cut it open with a knife, and return here to me.
So the woman went home, took a pillow off her bed, a knife from the drawer, went up the fire escape to her roof, and stabbed the pillow. Then she went back to the old parish priest as instructed.
Did you gut the pillow with a knife?
He says.
Yes, Father. And what was the result?
Feathers, she said. Feathers, he repeated.
Feathers everywhere, Father. Now, I want you to go back and gather up every last feather that flew out on the wind. Well, she said, it can't be done. I don't know where they went. The wind took them all over. And that, said Father O'Rourke, is gossip.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm just, you know, thinking about him playing Scotty in Boogie Nights, you know, because that was the first. I'd seen him in, you know, in Twister and, you know, in Heartache, but it was in Boogie Nights and Cinema Woman too, although I have very little recollection of that film. But the performance in Boogie Nights was the thing that really grabbed me, that I said, mm-hmm. Well, we're going to see a lot more of him because, you know, he took that very small role and imbued it with so much, I don't know, there was a mixture of pain and loneliness, of course, and a big dollop of loneliness goes through almost his entire career, mm-hmm. almost all of his, many of his characters, have an incredible loneliness. Even if they're still fully engaged with the world, there's still maybe a little bit of solipsism to it. I don't know, but definitely a lot of pain in that performance in Boogie Nights, and
mm-hmm.
Just that sort of sense that the guy can't even get clothes that fit right or can hardly even speak a sentence, you know. He's so crippled with this confusion about his attraction to Mark Wahlberg, and, you know, of course that scene where he makes an advance to Wahlberg and is rebuffed and still trying to show him his new car. You want to go for a ride in it? And then just his complete breakdown behind the wheel of the car, calling himself an idiot.
Great, hey, yeah, really great. You want to go for a ride? Or?
Wait, fuck, hell, how much time is that?
I'm sorry, sir.
What the hell is the matter with you?
I'm sorry,
why did you do that, Scotty?
You look at me sometimes.
What?
I just want to know if you like me.
Well, of course. Yeah, I like you, Scotty.
Can I kiss you?
Scotty,
please,
I don't...
Please, can I kiss you on the mouth?
No!
Please let me.
Scotty!
I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to grab you like that or scare you or anything.
All right, man.
Do you want to kiss me or...
Scotty!
No?
What's the matter with you?
I forget it. I'm really drunk. Really, I am. I'm out of my head. I'm really wasted. Really, Dirk,
yeah,
I'm really just wasted. I'm crazy right now. I'm really crazy.
Do you want to go back inside?
Do you like my car, Dirk?
What?
I mean...
Yeah.
Because I wanted to, you know, I wanted to make sure you thought it was cool or else I was going to take it back.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's great, Scotty.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
I love you. I really love you.
I love you too, Scotty.
Okay.
Let's go back inside, okay?
All right. All right.
And then after that, you know, you see something, you know, in the year after that, you see something like The Big Lebowski, you know, where he's just hysterical and kind of like, again, there's a certain sort of loneliness there because he's got a job dealing with a very difficult, you know, boss, but he's completely devoted to him, but yet they're living in this sort of cloistered lifestyle in this mansion, you know, and really you can feel that Brandt has nothing, his character in Lebowski, has nothing to really hang his whole world on except dealing with his charge, you know, and he shows all of that stuff, but it's also incredibly funny in the sense that, you know, he's just such a sort of sickening toady in that film, you know, and so phony, you know, like so hilariously phony in a lot of those scenes, particularly in the scene where he first meets Jeff Lebowski and shows him around.
As you can see, the various commendations, awards, citations, honorary degrees, etc.
Very impressive.
Oh, please feel free to inspect them.
Please.
That is the key to the city of Pasadena, which Mr. Lebowski received 2 years ago in recognition of his various civic... That's the Los Angeles Chamber of Commerce Business Achiever Award, which is given, not necessarily given every year, given only when there's a worthy somebody.
Is this him with Nancy?
Yes, indeed. That is Mr. Lebowski with the First Lady, yes. Oh. Let's take in when Mrs.
That's
Reagan...
That's Lebowski on the left there?
Yeah, of course, Mr. Lebowski on the left.
So he's a handicapped guy?
Mr. Lebowski is disabled, yes. This picture was taken when Mrs. Reagan was First Lady of the Nation. Yes, yes. Not of California.
There's just so many little details in all of his little scenes that are just, you know, fantastic. I mean, this film is filled with lots of details, but you know, you just single out his performance in that, and just every single move he makes, you know, every wince, every sort of tensing up of his body as Jeff Lebowski is investigating all of the pictures and everything. It's on Lebowski's wall. It's just amazing, you know, and just also incredibly physical, you know. Like, I remember in Lebowski that great moment where Hoffman opens the doors to Lebowski's inner sanctum or whatever, and with this just great, huge sort of wild, overly dramatic kind of "here it is," you know, thing that he does. It's just you know, great. So I mean, he was able to make you laugh as well, you know, and with all the little details. But of course, a lot of the things that he did throughout his career were things that really made you kind of either wince or just kind of want to break down sobbing.
Of course.
Well, he did all but two of P.T. Anderson's feature films, There Will Be Blood and the new one, Inherent Vice.
Right.
So, and P.T. Anderson gave him, obviously, he and P.T. Anderson hit it off with Hard Eight, and he kept returning to him and gave him such a gallery of different characters.
Right.
And I really think that The Master is just kind of like the ultimate cap on that collaboration. I mean, sadly, it has to be the cap on it. But it is a masterful performance. And he's performing across from someone in Joaquin Phoenix. Yeah.
It's a powerhouse duo. I mean,
it really is. But he, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman is really like a stabilizing force. And as soon as I saw him in that movie, I was so taken with his voice. He had such a commanding, clear, bass-toned voice, and it made me think of, like, the other characters that he played, the completely opposite kind of voice that he puts on for Capote, or and it's I don't know what exactly his process was in terms of how much the external determined what the interior life of his characters were, because every actor has a kind of a different process with that. But I mean, it was the, like you said, Dean, it was the physicality and the vocal characteristics and all of that stuff that just made him so vivid and different in everything. But and I think about the Master, and there's another high wire performance as well, just like Doubt, because he's a man of great presence in the movie, and he kind of commands your attention, and yet he could quite possibly be a complete kook and a fraud.
A fraud, yeah. Most,
yeah. Mm-hmm. An
empty shell.
He toes that line there too.
Often you don't know whether he's you know, I mean, there's that scene in The Master where the I guess it's Jesse Plemons playing his in that movie.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And there's that scene where Jesse Plemons says, you know, he's just making it up as he goes along. You know, I could fall asleep right now and not miss anything about what he's saying, because So you do spend a lot of the movie wondering, okay, is there anything to this? And that's kind of where a lot of the drama of that movie comes in, because it's also up to Freddie Quell to decide. But also what's interesting about The Master, too, is the fact that Hoffman is able to portray, even with all those doubts that we kind of come into the movie with. I mean, we all knew, at least the most studied of us knew that it was a movie that was kind of based on L. Ron Hubbard and so forth. But, you know, what's interesting about that film is that, you know, a lot of what the character Lancaster Dodd does for Freddie Quell actually works. it actually does help him go to another plane to get over a lot of it.
They kind of need each other. They need each other. I mean, I think. I mean, because I do think, you know, by the end of the movie, I mean, there are scenes where Philip Seymour Hoffman looks exasperated dealing with Freddie. And rightfully so. But he does say to him at the end, he says the most important thing in the movie: if you can find a way to live without a master, you will be the first person in the history of humanity to do it.
Yeah.
And it's like he's almost wanting, you know, saying, look, if you can do it, more power to you. And I always felt that was quite a last line.
But you talk about the supporting performances that are incredibly vivid and lived in. Moneyball was that for me. Here he's playing the baseball coach, and I've always said about him in that movie, he didn't have to open up his mouth. He just appeared on screen, and you knew he was that guy. Talk about exasperated and world-weary and just tired of living. that's what you got from that character. It was this beautiful performance, like this jewel of a little performance in that movie.
Oh, it's a great little movie. I didn't even know he was. I mean, they kept saying in the trailer he's in it, and you don't see him at all in the trailer. And then you watch the movie, and when he is that, you know, when he's on screen, like you said, he doesn't have to say anything. You just know his presence is just
and
there.
His expressions at Brad Pitt, like, "What the hell are you doing to me? I can't take much more."
You're killing me, Pitt.
Yeah, and he doesn't have to say anything. It just all transmits in his face.
You can't start Pena first tonight. You'll have to start Hatterberg.
Yeah, I don't want to go 15 rounds, Billy. The lineup card is mine, and that's all.
Okay, the lineup card is definitely yours. I'm just saying you can't start Pena first.
Well, I am starting him at first.
I don't think so. He plays for Detroit now.
You traded Pena?
You know, I went to NYU back in 86 just for a couple of semesters, and I made a lot of great friends there. And one of my friends that I met there is named Gary Sherwood, and he's out in California. He's working as a screenwriter and as a DJ and radio DJ and so forth. Anyway, he let me know while I'm learning through Facebook that, and I remember him talking about this too in the past, that he and Philip Seymour Hoffman were actually classmates together in an improvisational class or an acting class. And I was curious about his remembrances of Hoffman, and so he wrote this. I'm going to read it. He said, it was the spring of 87 semester. As I tell everyone, I wouldn't have pegged him for an acting student. He wasn't a pretentious artiste in black. He was big, and I thought he was a football player. But in every class exercise, he had that same level of commitment you saw on screen. I remember there was one exercise where we were instructed to make our acting partner do something against their will. Of course, all Phil had to do was stand full height, raise his voice ever so slightly, and take a couple of steps forward. And I remember his partner scrambling backwards and almost tripping. I never really got to know Phil or his good friend Bennett Miller, for that matter, and God, I wish I did. Anyway, I never really thought much about Phil until 7 years after graduation, and I'm in a theater seeing Twister, and who should appear but one Philip Seymour Hoffman as a welcome comic relief in an otherwise lame movie, and I've been a fan ever since. So I thought that was an interesting movie.
That's nice. There's another film, though, that I think really, and he's missed from this other director's films, and that's Happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Be superb in Happiness.
Talk about a character that I can't really imagine many other people agreeing to play.
The
bravery of playing some of those seeds in that movie.
Am I wrong in saying this? I've seen every movie except I think Dark Horse by Todd Solondz, and I think after that you realize that kind of performance is missing from the later films, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Just a daring, bravado, creepy, unsettling movie, but his performance, I think, is the personification of the whole movie. I think he just sort of embodies everything that movie to me represents. It's like sort of like, to me, that's always been like the standout indie gem of the mid-90s, or late 90s, actually. And
definitely the standout of Talon's career, I agree.
Because the others, you look at the other ones that come after it, and it's just sort of like he really has dug himself into this hole he can't get out of. He's almost, I hate to say it, but the later films almost feel like parodies of themselves.
Have that kind of heart that those performances that like Jane Addams and Philip Seymour Hoffman and even Dylan Baker bring to that film,
right.
You know, I mean, like, none of the other films have an ensemble like that, and particularly, they're missing somebody like Philip Seymour Hoffman. A lot of Stallone's movies tend to feel a little heartless, and it's true, I am being kind, but with someone like Hoffman in that role, it's impossible to feel like there's no heart in it.
Right.
You think about Scent of a Woman and Twister, two of his first kind of movies, and you think this guy could have easily been, like you said, Jerry typecast, and he could have been typecast as the smart-ass Belushi kind of guy.
Right.
You could have seen him playing a version of a frat boy in every movie. When in fact, obviously it was a lot more, the career path he took and the choices he made were a lot more complicated than that, thank God. And then you see my favorite comedic performance of his is like a really kind of forgettable romantic comedy, that Along Came Polly movie, which is generic.
He's hysterical in that.
He is so funny. It's like as far as you can take that kind of frat boy pretentious, thinks too much of himself.
He's one of the funniest lines in the movie. I mean, I burst out laughing when I saw them. When they have to leave the party, he goes, "We have to go. I sharted. We have to leave. I have to go now." I was on the floor. Because you're right. It is a forgettable. You think it's, but when he's on screen, it's hysterical. I mean, you can't stop laughing.
That little basketball game that they have where he's yelling out little things while making the basket, like, "Oh, no!" And then the thing bounces off of the backboard. that's pretty hilarious. You know?
One of my friends, Tim Williams, since Dean, you read a little recollection of him. He wrote this today. He said, 3 years ago, a good friend gave me the opportunity to not only meet one of my heroes, but to spend an entire evening sharing his company over a poker game, several cigarettes, and 2 20-ounce cans of Red Bull. The most significant thing about that night was that once the shock and awe of being in the presence of the most gifted character actor I've ever seen since Gary Oldman, Philip was just one of the guys. There were no costumes and lights, makeup or script, no romantic aura of celebrity or pretentiousness. Philip was a deliberate and soft-spoken man for most of that evening. We were playing poker after all. He radiated an underlying intensity that drew focus not because of his celebrity, but because of his quiet strength and a reserved calm, broken only by his passionate and animated contributions to our conversations. He just said he was incredibly human, and he would talk to him about the joys and fears of being a father and how proud he was of his theater company, and he expressed a burning desire to dabble in cable television. He shared music on his iPod with the enthusiasm of a high school boy introducing a brand new band to his friends, and he refused the liquor being consumed during the game by telling me he'd been sober since graduating college. And you got the
we talk about
this a lot. We talked about this with Gandolfini too, that both of them in some way, I mean, kind of a larger than life talent, but they never abandoned their kind of, you felt like you were them, like you knew that person.
Mm-hmm.
They never, because it was in their DNA. They couldn't get rid of that. They were every man, you know.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite performances of his that, you know, again from a P.T. Anderson movie, but, you know, that performance as Phil Parma, the hospice worker in Magnolia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's okay, so you got this 3-hour movie and there's 10 million people in it, you know, and half of them are, it's like half of SAG is in this movie. And then here is this guy who really most of his scenes are performed pretty much alone. You know, they're either you know, on the phone, or he's talking with, you know, Jason Robards, as the old man that he's dying TV producer that he's taking care of. And, a lot of his performance is listening, and he even makes listening into something that's powerful, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to gather what words the man is saying and what he's asking for, and then also being on the phone and trying to convince a worker, like a telephone worker, to do something extraordinary for him. That scene where he's trying to convince that worker, you know, he says, "This is the scene in the movie, you know, this is the scene." That scene is ridiculous. And then, you know, when the frogs start falling in the movie, I think, you know, that reaction shot of Philip Seymour Hoffman turning and looking out to the pool behind the house and he's like, "Oh my God, there's frogs." the tears in his eyes and the incredible shock on his face. I mean, that's an amazing performance too. Also, because it's one of the only performances in the film, one of the only characters in the film that just seems actually truly giving from the heart.
Right.
Well, that's what you know, I saw an interview with him, and they were reviewing kind of each movie in his career. And when it came to Magnolia, he started to get emotional, and he said that movie and that character just destroy me because he's all about giving. And mm-hmm. so he felt like a real sensitivity to that character. That was a special one for him, I know.
That mm-hmm. was, a truly heroic performance, you know. Yeah. One of the few real heroes that he plays, that he's played in the movies, you know, who's just really trying to do something pretty extraordinary. There are other heroes that he plays, like Lester Bangs in Almost Famous, you know.
Oh, he's great in that, yeah.
Yeah, he's fantastic in that, too. I mean, again, you know, this is a guy that could just lighten up a movie, you know, the entire movie, just by being in two or three scenes, you know.
So, and never more so than something like something that could have easily been a throwaway, like a Mission Impossible 3. And I'm thinking, when they first announced that casting, I said, what? Philip Seymour Hoffman is doing Mission Impossible 3? I was like, it was another kind of delicious change of pace for him that I'm sure he embraced being a part of.
Mm-hmm. It almost makes you wonder, like, you know, what it might have been like if he had been in, like, something like a superhero movie or something, like, you know, like how Paul Giamatti is cast
doing Spider-Man.
In the new Spider-Man. I was like, you know, what would have Hoffman been like in one of those movies? He would have certainly elevated it, you know.
Really, he would have been very good. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, he would have been. But you know what's really the other is? I mean, it's all very sad. But he was a great director, too. I really thought Jack Goes Boating was a great little movie, and that mm-hmm. would have been great to see some more things that he directed. Because that's a film that's not really talked about a lot, and it's got some great performances in it, and that's something else we're not going to get to see, because I was always hoping he would direct something else.
He's obviously, you know, he's a stage director as well, so he had plenty of experience, and probably something that he might have been saving for us, you know, in some ways,
yeah.
you know.
He was about to direct his next movie. He just cast Amy Adams and Jake Gyllenhaal in it. Mm. So he had, you know, everything to look forward to.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, you know, I regret never having seen him on stage because I'm friends with someone on Twitter and we've communicated here and there, like just briefly about movies and stuff. I mean, not in depth, but just through retweets and comments and that kind of stuff. But
he
directed Philip Seymour Hoffman twice. He directed him A Long Day's Journey and Tonight, which for Broadway, and he and that's a performance that Philip Seymour Hoffman said was the toughest for him. He said that almost mm-hmm. killed him. And then he directed him, I think, in Othello, maybe something mm-hmm. else, but. I read an interview with him yesterday, and he said, you know, he was a guy that did not drop character. He knew no other way but to kind of exist in that skin
mm-hmm.
Throughout the duration of it. And, you know, he was there through the whole 4.5-hour Eugene O'Neill play.
Yeah.
It tortured a lot out of him. I think the one that I wish I could have seen was the Mike Nichols production of Death of a Salesman.
Oh, yeah.
Because
I wish I had.
At first it seems like, you know, isn't he too young to play Willie Loman? But you think about the reserves of loneliness and disappointment and anger that he had, and that's Willie Loman. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it makes total sense for him to play Willie Loman. It was he and Andrew Garfield in that production that Mike Nichols directed on Broadway last year, or 2012.
Mm-hmm.
That must have been mammoth.
that's the interesting thing about his performance in The Master, too, because he seems to, without benefit of any makeup, really, he seems to have aged, you know, like maybe a couple more decades than we were used to seeing him. So something about the cut of the hair and the mustache and so forth, and just the we're also kind of used to seeing him in kind of rumpled suits and or clothes just in general, and like, or you know, clothes are, you know, he's very good with, like, you know, communicating a lot with just the clothes that he's wearing, you know, like, again, like in Boogie Nights or mm-hmm. like in Lebowski.
Or Charlie Wilson's War. I mean,
Charlie Wilson's War is just,
exactly.
Yeah.
But, but that's those suits that he's wearing and the way he wears the suits in as Lancaster Dodd in The Master, that's another thing that sort of just instantly can age him in a way. So he was able to use all of those tools that come from other artisans too to his best advantage. You know, I mean,
and you just rewatched Schenectady, New York today, right, Dean?
Schenectady, New York just tore me up. Because, you know, you're watching it, and you're like, I haven't really revisited it. I love the movie, but it's a difficult film, and so I hadn't revisited it in a little while. And watching it here, I say, man, there's so much of him in this movie. I mean, like, mm-hmm. so much that he put into this movie that really came from, I mean, it even has him, you know, he played Willie Loman in college, what I've read, and here it is in Schenectady where he's trying to stage a production of a disastrous kind of production of Death of a Salesman, or at least overly ambitious, I guess. There's a scene in it where he says, "Yeah, there's 600 lighting cues in this thing." Which is an absurd number of lighting cues for a play, there's so much of him in that film you can feel him pouring his concerns about his own mortality into it, about you know, his body kind of falling apart almost, and the concerns over his family and being separated mm-hmm. from them, and just the sort of like trying to get your arms around a artistic endeavor that almost seems outside of your this character's grasp, at least,
mm-hmm.
and really going the extra mile to get it perfect, you know, all of
right.
that stuff is in Schenectady, and I think that is. That's absolutely who he was, you know. I mean, you could just feel it by just the commitment in every performance that he did. And this is that person. He is that person, you know. It's not often that a celebrity death, you know, just an artist's death, just, you know, completely floors you. And this is just one of those. This is one of those instances that's just, you know. You know, it's always going to be a wound, you know, and that's just never going to heal over. But the greatest thing that we can say is that, you know, I mean, for two decades of work, that guy just churned out almost nothing but great work. I mean, I can't even point to anything that I would say was bad in his entire career, and that's just something that you just can't say.
So if you were to recommend one movie to watch for our listeners in memory of him tonight, what would it be?
I would definitely watch The Master or Schenectady, New York, definitely. I would, you know, Or, it's interesting also to go and take a look at his, you know, more supporting performances too. But those two performances, I think, are so key to who he was and his range and I also think they're two of the greatest movies. But also Magnolia. I mean, frankly.
And Jerry, what about you?
I would take two supporting performances, Charlie Wilson's War and The Talented Mr. Ripley. Two very different performances, but just the way, especially Charlie Wilson's War, it's just the way he steals the movie from everybody. That
uh-huh.
performance is, and I love that scene where he's talking, where he, with his boss, John Slattery, is, you know,
yeah.
He just, what he does in
yeah.
that scene is just classic.
Completely rails on him, yeah.
I would love to see his true West.
I've been recommending owning Mahoney, just because it's one of those movies that isn't really seen much. I would put Owning Mahoney and Flawless back to back and
mm-hmm.
challenge people to see the same person. I mean, that's just staggering. And think about that being his first lead performance opposite, you know, what many people consider the greatest actor alive, Robert De Niro, and think about how much he distinguishes himself in that performance.
Yeah,
it's,
right.
And again, like, not playing the cartoon of it, which a lot of actors would. All right, so thank you, guys.
Thank you. And close out the show with that song, the song that I asked you to close the show with is called Little Person, and it's by John Bryan and Charlie Kaufman, and it's from Schenectady, New York, and I just think the song is beautiful.
I'm just a little